Good morning and welcome. You have got your dial tuned to 2SER 107.3, and since it's 10 o'clock, that must mean it is time to talk books, writing and literary culture on Final Draft. I know this because I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I get to put together Final Draft for you, bringing amazing talent from the literary world in Australia and beyond. And Saturday, March 17th, and the offerings from Australian literature continue to be strong. I am really happy to be presenting today a conversation with Catherine Kovacic about The Portrait of Molly Dean. The murder of Mary Dean happened in 1930s Melbourne, and as quickly as the crime appeared and shocked the city, it disappeared with no charges ever being brought. And justice was not served for Molly Dean. Catherine Kovacic picks up the story as an art dealer discovers a missing portrait of Molly Dean and seeks to discover what happened to her. This is a really fascinating, engaging book set across two time eras, and wondering how we respond to violence against women, and has much changed since the 1930s. Later on in the show, we're going to be talking about the Sydney Writers' Festival program. The festival is coming up at the end of April, and the program dropped on Thursday night in the new festival home of Carriage Works. I was really fortunate to be there, and I'm excited to be sharing some thoughts on the program. Now, of course, you can check out the program yourself. I'm not going to be able to talk about all the hundreds of artists, but I would like to offer my thoughts and share with you what you've got to expect from the new festival home in Everleigh. It is on Final Draft, 2SER 107.3, where books, writing and literary culture, and we're going to be talking about all of them just after this very short break.
Yo, it's the Gumball. Now in its 13th year, this year the festival goes down April 27 to 29. Haven't heard of Gumball? You need to check it out. Held over 3 days at Dashville in the Hunter Valley, it's regarded by many as Australia's best boutique camping music festival. It's BYO, all ages and perfect for families. Catch 30 amazing live acts, great food and markets, and loads of activities. Head to thegumball.com.au for all the info on tickets and who's playing. Dashville sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Dreaming of adventure in the NT? Outback Music Festival, Wide Open Space, could make your dream come true. Submit your 10-day travel itinerary to socials before March 29 with the hashtag WOSAreYouWaitingFor. The winning entry will encompass what the NT and Wide Open Space are all about. Imagine sunsets while listening to your favourite artists in iconic Australian scenery. Enter now. Wide Open Space Festival sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Good morning. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and you are listening to Final Draft. It is books, writing and literary culture. And I'm joined on the line by Catherine Kovacic. She's the author of The Portrait of Molly Dean. It is a fantastic story taking us back into 1930s Melbourne. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
It is an absolute pleasure. As I just mentioned, The Portrait of Molly Dean takes the reader into the heart of 1930s Melbourne society, where a young woman on the cusp of breaking into the writing world is brutally murdered. The city is shocked, but just as quickly as the scandal arises, it disappears, with all charges dropped against the prime suspect. Take us forward to 1999, and art dealer Alex Clayton has discovered an unattributed portrait that she knows is the work of famed artist Colin Colohan. Featured in the portrait is Molly Dean, murdered nearly 70 years earlier, a crime left unsolved. Alex thought she could quickly flip the painting and make a profit, but as she researches Molly's story, she's drawn into the case and the injustice perpetrated against a young woman seemingly scorned for her ambition. I love it. I love the way you've created these dual narratives as well. But Catherine, can we start with Molly Dean? Tell us a little bit about who she was and how her story captured you.
I think I first came across Molly almost 20 years ago, Andrew, and I came across her as a footnote to Colin Colohan's story. As you said, she had aspirations of becoming a novelist, but she was a special education teacher and she was Colin Colohan's lover. So she was trying to get herself out of the teaching world, out of that sort of middle class job, and become a famous novelist in Australia. And as part of that, she'd become involved in this Melbourne artistic circle that Colin was sort of the centre of.
Now, you mentioned there that you came across her as a footnote in, I guess, a biography, or maybe just more figuratively, a footnote in general to Colin Colihan's story. And very much, I think, what you've done here in the portrait of Molly Dean is actually give a woman who has really never had her voice, this case was left unsolved, a chance to actually be a central figure and maybe in some small way get the justice that she needs.
I'm so glad you said that, because that was exactly what I was trying to do. I think I really felt sorry for her, that her whole life had been reduced to, oh, this was someone that he painted and who he went out with for a while, and he got very upset when she was brutally murdered. And that was really the extent of what has been written about her in terms of her involvement in that artistic group. So it was, that was what I really wanted to do, was to sort of bring her to life and give her a little bit of that recognition that I think she was craving back then in 1930.
And perhaps maybe also speaks a little to the circumstances that women lived under, this idea that, to again borrow your phrase, they were in some way a footnote adjacent to the world that they lived in.
Yeah, I think very much so. And I think for Molly, coming from that middle-class background, her father was a teacher and she'd become a teacher, and she'd moved into this really bohemian circle where it was, you know, and particularly in the jazz age, you know, there was becoming much more this sense of a little bit of sexual revolution, but much more of that anything goes and being a little bit freer and a little bit more open in public. And so I think that was a really big thing for her to cross. Much easier to do if you were a man. You know, Colin Colihan is an artist. He seemed to be able to go out with multiple women, as did various other artists in his group. But for a girl like Molly, you know, she had to tread very carefully with her education department job while also trying to break into this artistic group.
You flesh out her character beautifully. I mean, I found Molly Dean, the Molly Dean you put on the page, as someone admirable, someone that I would love to get to know. And you talk there a little bit about her story of actually trying to escape her circumstance to pursue an ambition. Hers was an artistic ambition. You also create a character, Donald Rayburn, who is literally, he does the male equivalent of that with so much more ease. He rises from poor circumstances to make it to the top very quickly at a very young age. And thinking more broadly, you work within the facts of Molly Dean, the case of Molly Dean, her murder, but you also create characters, you flesh out the characters that you have to give within the circumstances of the time. Was it difficult reconciling fact and the realm of fiction?
Yes, it was. I think because no one was ever ultimately tried for her murder, and yet there were several people that the police were highly suspicious of, I wanted to not necessarily exonerate them completely, because there was obviously things going on around Molly, but, you know, there wasn't enough evidence against them. So I needed to sort of find a way to give a little bit of closure to Molly's story, but also leave those people well and truly in her narrative.
Mm. Well, you had to make decisions, didn't you? I have spoken to authors before who have suggested to me that they wanted to allow the reader to make up their mind about certain things, but you had to make a decision about where you were going to, at least, spoiler alert, I am not going to give away spoilers here, of course, but you had to make decisions about where you would point the finger and how you would pursue the facts as they exist into your fictional world. What were you hoping to do there? Or was that another difficult thing where you wanted to try and leave something open?
I did want to try and leave something open. And I think because there were also some files missing as part of Molly's case, I think
that's really true. An
interesting fact as well. And there was various theories put up at the time. You know, they looked, could it have been, you know, this person or that person, or could it have been, you know, a random maniac? Could it have been a woman? Even came up at one stage, which was, you know, going out there for a fairly brutal murder in 1930 to suddenly think that a woman could do this. So I didn't necessarily want to. I want to leave the reader a little bit of something of that true story and a little bit of the mystery that was going on at the time.
Mm. So Molly's life was circumscribed by expectations on her to be a certain type of daughter, a certain type of woman, that her artistic ambition stood in stark contrast to. In Alex Clayton, I felt like you created a foil to the overwhelmingly male art world that seemingly was there to thwart Molly. You juxtaposed their movements as well. I noticed I couldn't help but note there was a scene where Alex is attacked in the novel, mm-hmm. but manages to fend off her assailant.
Yep.
Thinking about the two eras, the two women, do you feel that there has been significant change in these perceptions of women, or is Alex still labouring under some of the same circumstances as Molly?
I think there's been significant change. Alex, she is labouring under some of the same expectations, but she's able to push ahead and push through it. So she's very much an independent woman, and she's in her own business. She's not relying on anybody, but she still does come up with sort of various blocks and things, and you'll find in Alex's world that there are still sort of, you know, very, shall we say, ebullient men who sort of almost virtually pat her on the head and say, you know, I've done you a great favour, here you go, when really it's not what she wants at all. So she does still have those kind of things to contend with, but she's in a much better position than Molly is, and she also tends to be a bit bullheaded, so she just blazes ahead and does what she wants anyway.
Some wonderful juxtapositions you create. It didn't escape my notice that you begin in an alley. Alex is very much in a circumstance where perhaps in Molly's time she might be attacked, she might fall victim herself, but here she's very much in control. She's making sort of a shady back alley deal with a painting. You also saw contrasted the relationships between the daughter and the mother, with Alex calling on her mother and having a very different type of conversation. Was it important for you to create these contrasts?
I think so, and I think particularly in the maternal situation, because Molly's mother was such a domineering and in many ways a very nasty woman. So it was such a strange relationship there. So I definitely wanted to create those contrasts in Molly and Alex's world. Mm.
The impact of violence against women looms large throughout the novel. In fact, you'd say it almost wholly informs the novel. Molly is watchful, yet she's still attacked. Her case is dismissed, and it seems as if her life is worth less than the male institutions that it might threaten. Now, Alex is better able to fight back. We've just talked about the scene where she is attacked, but that still is bred from a point of view, a mindset where she is vigilant. She feels that she needs to know how to fight back. She has to live in a world where violence is presumed as a tool against her, as we see countless times throughout the novel. What do you think Alex's mission and her mission to sort of see some sort of resolution for Molly speaks to in our current lives of Me Too and Time's Up? I mean, obviously this was written probably before a lot of that movement took shape, but are you conscious of that now?
Very much so, and I think, as you say, the Me Too sort of movements have arisen much more recently than when I was writing this, but for me that was in the back of my mind as a motivator for Alex, that it was, she could see this woman who had had nothing and had had no voice for her. And, you know, ordinarily Alex is a very money-driven sort of person. You know, she'd flip a painting if someone offered her money straight away, no questions asked. But in this case, there's something about Molly, and it's that not having a voice that's really gotten Alex in, and she almost wants to empower Molly by default.
You create a circumstance too that we see far too often where, I mean, this case is at the time of the setting of the novel almost 70 years old. I mean, realistically, we're now looking at something that's close to 90 years old. But wherever Alex turns, and ultimately she's met with this idea that anything she finds is hearsay, that perhaps Molly shouldn't be believed for anything that any of her voice that we might hear coming down through the ages, that perhaps things were misinterpreted. It's all the same old tired stuff that we hear forced against women that are making claims. Let's take this as a comment, because I really like that you saw, or you had Alex see through that mission, despite the fact that it might not have broad publicity in the world you create.
Yeah, I think that was really important, because I think with Molly, even in reading some of the newspaper accounts, you know, they'd say, oh, there was, of course, the jealous lover theory, and had she gone out with this person or that person, and her mother was saying, oh, you know, look at this man she might have spoken to. And so, without sort of wanting to use an phrase, there was almost an element of a bit of, like, slut-shaming, that, you know, she'd almost brought it on herself because she'd moved into this bohemian circle. And what could you possibly expect from a girl who was living like that and walking home by herself late at night? So I think, yes, it was a really important sort of element to bring through in the book.
I think in a week where we have a former deputy PM actively slut-shaming in the media. You are allowed to say that word. Another thing that's perhaps more of a curiosity for me is that you've set the novel in 1999. Was there a specific reason for that? Because, of course, that's a time when a lot of things that we now take for granted are only emerging, and it's really sort of almost a cross-sectional year.
It was a really interesting year to sort of work in, and I had in the back of my mind that sort of almost Y2K thing with regard to technology, but I didn't end up sort of going in that direction. But yes, it was, I think I wanted to have that, almost that difficulty for Alex, that you couldn't just log on and find things quite easily. The idea of her going into the library and having to look through things, even if only on microfiche, rather than, you know, just sitting down and logging onto Trove and seeing what she could find in the newspapers. So I wanted her to have some difficulty, and I also wanted to still have a time frame that we could possibly have someone alive or multiple people alive who could remember what had happened back in 1930.
The mystery that we are discussing is The Portrait of Molly Dean. It is the debut novel from Catherine Kovacic. Catherine, I'm loving delving into the case of Molly Dean. Now, of course, you can't tell us who done it, because it is still an unsolved case, but you present some really fascinating theories. One thing before I let you go, though, I thought it was really, really wonderful as we move through the novel, we become quite close to Alex as your protagonist. And in the penultimate scene, we have Alex Hogarth, I forget what type of dog Hogarth is. He's quite
Irish
big, though.
Wolfhound.
Irish Wolfhound. He's quite big.
Yes.
And John, her restoration specialist, mm-hmm. are driving to what they believe is the killer's home. Forgive me for this, but were you conscious of a sense of Scooby-Doo?
Absolutely. But I think Alex and John in particular is a very daggy sort of character. So I think that's almost their vibe. They kind of have that dialogue between them where they just sort of riff off each other.
Mm.
So yes, I think there is definitely with the dog sitting in the back seat with his head coming between the two of them, and they're not sort of the kick the door in guns blazing kind of crime fighters here. It's an art restorer and an art dealer, so there's always going to be a little bit of Scooby Doo as far as they're concerned, I think.
Just the enormous dog between them too. I deliberately left that question at the end. I thought I don't want you to be insulted and hang up the phone on me, but. All it would have taken is for them to pull Donald Raben's face off and unmask the real killer. And
then he would have been able to say, I would have gotten away for it if it wasn't for you pesky
kids.
That's
yep.
right.
Brilliant. You took the words right out of my mouth. I'm speaking with Catherine Kovacic. We are discussing The Portrait of Molly Dean. It is a fantastic novel taking us back to the true crime, the murder of Mary Dean in 1930s Melbourne, and exploring the issues that arise from such violence. Catherine, thank you so much for joining me on Final Draft.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I think that it is time for us to take a track. Thank you very much to Catherine for discussing with me The Portrait of Molly Dean. Now, this is new from Sydney artists Flower Truck. It's off their new album, and it is called Komichi.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3, and this is Final Draft on another bookish Saturday morning. That was from Sydney band Flower Truck. The track was called Kimichi. It's off their latest, which is called Mostly Sunny, which it would be nice if it could stay mostly sunny for a little bit longer. So anyway, look, the Sydney Writers Festival, always a key set of dates in the literary calendar, they launched their program on Thursday night at the Sydney Writers Festival's new home of Carriage Works in the inner west suburb of Everleigh. Now, however you arrived at the event, I caught the train and walked a bit, you would have been struck by the contrast between the old festival site of Walsh Bay, shining on the harbour, and the new festival site, Carriage Works, housed in the refurbished Everleigh rail yards, all polished grunge and practical cool. Inside the bays of Carriage Works for the launch, the new venue revealed itself to be spacious and yet still intimate in a way that Walsh Bay, with its expanse of water, could never achieve. Less of an island in the city, Carriage Works felt connected. Still a distance from the expanses of Western Sydney, Carriage Works, though, allows audiences to stretch out across the rails and access the festival easily. So as we gathered behind darkened curtains and hidden among the engineering workshops, this felt like the scene of a cultural uprising, cribbing off the revolutionary past of the Everleigh rail yards and the great 1917 strike, and it had the makings of this sort of new challenge to the establishment, albeit with better catering. It's fitting, then, that the theme for this year's festival is power. Now, artists and writers are not traditionally seen as powerful, kind of finger-on-the-button exercise of brute force like demigods and dictators. Writers may project power through their portrayal, their commentary, and their engagement in conversations about the nature of our world. Addressing the crowd, festival artistic director Michaela Maguire has observed that in our troubled times, many are questioning what it means to have power. Who holds it? How has it been abused and misused? Why and how it can be wrested back? It was a stirring call, and in the darkened room, we were allowed a sense that power may be available and exercisable directly through the creation of art. And with the backdrop of this darkened room in an old rail yard, we were presented with a program that sought to engage with contemporary discussion around paradigms of power, old and new. From the uprisings around Me Too, the stirrings for recognition of Indigenous sovereignty, and the rights of LGBTQI people post-marriage equality, through the power of populism to engage reactionary forces and Trumpian politics, the program presented opportunities for festival goers to understand the ebb and flow of power in their world and how literature might give them a voice, despite their own personal feelings of powerlessness. In announcing the artists, Michaela Maguire offered that right across the festival program, our guests will examine power and its adjacent qualities and its relationship to sex, money, politics, identity, and the state of the world. We'll be making a firm case for literature, stories, and public conversation helping resist the pull of a backward-lurching culture. The program is heavy with voices of narrative non-fiction. Journalists, podcasters, and memoirists describe for us a world in which the shift in power is skewed conservative and is threatening to divide and conquer for the favour of the 1%. In the Thinking Globally series, festival voices such as The Washington Post's Amy Goldstein, NBC News reporter Katie Turr, political science professor Robert E. Kelly from Vanity Fair correspondent Gabriel Sherman, and Asia editor for The Times Richard Lloyd Parry explore the schisms that have seen populism rise and empathy fail. Closer to home, we have local artists exploring the issues that have occupied our hearts and our headlines. Sally Rugg will moderate a discussion called Gay for Page, exploring queer literature with some of the festival's most esteemed guests, including Christos Chalkas, Issa Daly Ward, and Eileen Miles. Nakia Louie joins a host of international guests for My Feminism Will Be Intersectional or It Will Be Bullshit, as well as recording her podcast Pretty for an Aboriginal with festival guests. All Day YA is going to be returning to the Riverside Theatre in Parramatta, bringing a program that engages younger readers. And hang on a sec, let's all admit that we read YA, so engaging us all with topics that affect young Australians. Now, one way I like to take the temperature of the festival program each year is through the guest curators offering their own slice of dynamic literary conversation. And this year, select events are programmed by Sarah Krasnostein, Charlotte Wood, and Marsha Langton. Professor Marsha Langton is an anthropologist, a geographer, and one of Australia's most respected Indigenous academics. Her latest book is Welcome to Country, A Guide to Indigenous Australia. And she's programmed a selection of talks, including a discussion of her book and how we can better understand and appreciate more than 50,000 years of this country's history. Other conversations explore depictions of Indigenous Australians in literature and how characterizations may allow us to explore history and heritage to gain deeper understanding, or perhaps to rob Indigenous people of agency and entrench a culture of victimhood. Charlotte Wood's 2016 Stella Prize-winning novel, The Natural Way of Things, shocked and delighted readers with its nuanced and immediate portrayal of the violence committed daily against women simply for the crime of being. She has programmed a series of talks that explore the ways wit and humour engage us in our reading and allow us space and perspective to meet serious topics head-on. Sarah Krasnostein's first book, The Trauma Cleaner, won the 2017 Victorian Prize for Literature for its look at the extraordinary life of trauma cleaner Sandra Pankhurst. Sarah has created a selection of talks that explore our individual relationships with power and how empathy connects us and the ways in which we strengthen these ties through literature. I think I could probably make my festival experience just from those guest curators, and I love the way they're engaging us both globally and locally. There is much to be enjoyed in this year's festival program. I was only ever going to scratch the surface in the short time that I have with you. So in the new venue, look, it's allowed the program space to refocus and look globally to our relationships as a society, a global society, and yet it's also retained connections to the city and its stories. For me, going to the festival, I'm going to be looking local myself, discovering authors that speak to Sydney, speak to Australia. But as I sat with the program and a highlighter in hand last night, I realized that even just looking at this sort of section of the program that deals with fiction that's going to be local, I have more on offer than I can physically attend over the weekend. The Sydney Writers Festival program is out now and hitting up your Sydney Morning Herald spectrum this weekend. Or you can go online, you can go to swf.org.au to check it out. Now, the Sydney Writers Festival kicks off on Monday, the 30th of April, just over a month away, and runs through till the 6th of May. You are on Final Draft, 2OCR 107.3, talking books, writing and literary culture, but that is all I have time for this week. Thank you so much for joining me today, helping me get excited about books every week. I have an amazing conversation coming up next week with Michael Muhammad Ahmed about his new book, The Lebs. It is stunning. I can't speak enough about this book, but I'm going to leave it till next week when I have Michael in the studio with me talking about the book. Don't go anywhere. The Vulture's Nest is coming up in just a minute or two. I'm going to leave you now. I'm going to say goodbye. Keep reading this week and join me next week for more books. Bye for now.